I took the Charbonneau case on the same day an exceedingly creepy ex-boyfriend re-entered my life. The way the case played out and the reason the moron smashed back into my life were intimately related. It would have saved me no end of trouble if I'd known that from the start. I'm on the phone with my mother. "So are you seeing anybody?" she asks. Coming from my mother, that's not a question. It's a deep pit full of scorpions and irritable cobras. From her second-generation Italian-American perspective, the way my 34-year-old uterus was going unused was a disaster on par with Frank Sinatra's death. "Ma," I say in the universal warning tone, "don't start." "I was just asking," she says in the universal wounded tone. "I wanted to know if you were bringing someone to Brenda's wedding." That would be my cousin Brenda, who at the ripe old age of 23 is marrying a Port Authority cop she met while getting a ticket for drinking Stoli on the PATH train. I'm saved from the pit by Gerald, my secretary, who sticks his head around the corner of my door. "Someone to see you," he mouths. I nod and held up one finger. "Gotta go, Ma. Business," I say. "I wish you wouldn't," she was saying as I hung up the phone. It was one of those sentences I didn't want to hear the end of anyway. I step into my shoes, give my blouse a tug, and go to the door. In the outer office, Gerald is making the potential client feel at home by offering him bottled water, Ghirardelli chocolates, and the latest issue of Time Out. Gerald is a 6'4" hulk who could bench press a sanitation truck. Even in body-proud Chelsea, his ripped abs draw admiring stares from the street. But around certain guys, he turns into a cross between Martha Stewart and Jessica Rabbit. The client, I gotta admit, is cute. Even my calcified ovaries give a little hop when I first see him. He has nice hands, sandy hair cut short, a build like a baseball player, and clean, normal-looking teeth, not those big I-got-a-millionaire orthodontist choppers like Denzel Washington's. He's probably straight, too. He's wearing a polo shirt that's been out of style since the Carter administration. He stood up when I came into the room, looking anxious to get out from under the goodies Gerald was heaping on him. "Hi," he said, "you must be the karma detective." "Debbie," I say, holding out my hand. "Will Charbonneau," he says. He has a good handshake, firm but gentle. I get Will Charbonneau seated in my office and close the door. "I lost my girlfriend," he says without preamble, as soon as I sit behind my desk. "Lost her? Like missing person lost?" I say. "I'm not that kind of detective." "No, I know," he says. "I mean, I lost her to another guy. She was the love of my life." I take that with a blink. "I know, it sounds melodramatic," he says, "but I really, she was the one," I thought. Boy, have I heard that before. I know it won't do any good to say so to Will Charbonneau, though. "You probably hear that all the time," he says, holding a hand up. I know, but this is different, that's all I can say. "Why don't you tell me a little about her?" I ask him, taking out a reporter's notebook. "Her name is Becky Sandor." He digs his wallet out for a picture. I don't need to see a picture yet, but he needs to show me, so I let him. And I'm a little surprised. The recent Becky isn't half the physical specimen that Will is. She has a pretty smile and thick blonde hair, but she's on the skinny side and has a nose rather too big for her face. "Pretty," I say, handing it back. "Did she say why she left you?" "That's just it," Will answers. "She never said a word about it. Everything was fine, then one day she just up and left." He spins out the whole sad story for me. They met in the Peace Corps in Chad. I mentally revise Will's age upward into the low 30s, and found out they were from the same neighborhood in Queens. His year was up before hers, but as soon as they got back, they started dating. That was 3 years ago, and they'd been together ever since. Everything was great with them. They both taught social studies at public schools, and they were talking about getting married. They'd lived together for almost a year, and then last week, Will came home from school and found all her stuff gone, moved out. No note, no forwarding address. He goes to her school the next day, but all she'll say is that it's over and that she doesn't want to talk about it. He doesn't want to make a scene, so he goes. He hears from friends right away that she's with another guy, a car salesman, which is almost out of character for her as the disappearing act. He just can't understand it, Will can't, or accept it. There's nothing as inconstant as the human heart. God knows mine is. I love guys, you understand, just not for very long. No matter how handsome they are, or how funny, or how well they treat me, sooner or later I just lose that love and feeling. Usually sooner. Well, it may not be misdirected karma, or it might be her karma, not yours, Will, I say gently. And we have to consider the possibility that, karmically speaking, you had it coming. I tell all my clients this. I think of it as the moment of truth talk. How I proceed with a case depends a lot on the answer and on the tone of the answer I get. To his credit, Will doesn't get defensive or angry. "Yeah, I know," he said, after a moment's pause. "I give this a lot of thought before I came to you. But I think mostly I've been a pretty decent person. Not a perfect person, maybe, but a good one." He looks me right in the eye, Charbonneau does, and says, "Maybe it's an ego thing. I mean, a car salesman. But every day since she left, I wake up feeling like half of me is missing, and it's so inexplicable. I haven't heard anything yet that makes me think this is a case of stolen karma. I haven't heard anything yet that would definitely rule it out, either. But Occam's razor and all. I'm thinking about how to tell him that this case may not be for me," when he starts crying. I'm emphatically not one of those girls who's turned to mush by male tears. I grew up around the hypermasculine cops, firemen, and construction workers of Bensonhurst. You can take the girl out of the neighborhood and all. Still, the tears move me. He's not sobbing. The tears are just leaking from his eyes like he's not aware of them. "Probably I just need to let go," he says. "But it would be a lot easier to do if I understood what happened, even just a little." Before I know what I'm doing, I tell him I'll take the case. He looks almost as surprised as I am. I give him a box of Kleenex and get the pertinent details, where he lives, the school where Becky works, the names of mutual friends. "I don't know how much you charge," he says, his hand on the doorknob, "but I have a bunch saved up for the wedding." I quote him my fee, which is modest, and tell him that I'll only charge him for expenses if it turns out not to be the case of karma. When I see Will out, Gerald watches him go the way a dog watches a pork chop sail into the trash. "You're barking up the wrong tree," I say, when Charbonneau has disappeared down the stairs. "Oh, I know," Gerald says, "like you never window shop at Prada." "The difference is I might be able to afford Prada someday," I say, "and I might be crowned King of England." "You're already Queen of Barrow Street," I tell him. "It would be a come down." I was a biology major, if you can believe it. Then one day I was at the Brooklyn College Library avoiding studying sodium transport in cells, and I picked up a copy of Ralph Waldo Emerson's essays. Compensation hit me between the eyes like a cinder block. Since I was a little girl, I'd always known when people's karma was misaligned and understood that other people didn't know, except in some vague, he'll get his someday sense. Everything I knew about the way the world operated crystallized me in the 40 minutes it took me to read that essay. It took me another 5 years to find my calling. My father would have killed me if I dropped out of college. But from that moment on, I knew I was never going to spend my life studying the morphology of Caribbean land snails or some such thing. Like an electrical charge building up, karma wants to go where it's supposed to be. If you do good deeds all your life, and unlike most people, don't balance them out with crappy, self-serving actions, sooner or later, one or two great things or a whole bunch of smaller good things are going to happen to you. By the same token, if you're a total douchebag, the universe will pay you back. Sometimes, though, accounts get hung up. Karma behaves according to the second law of thermodynamics. It tends to even itself out to a uniform value over time. But there can be local and temporary pockets that resist that trend. You know some of the obvious examples: Pol Pot, Stalin, Paris Hilton, the exceptions that prove the rule. Think about all the lottery winners who are deeply in debt 5 years after the fact. Anyway, if I look at a person's life, talk to his friends and family, pet his dog, I can see where the karmic energy is pent up. More, I can make it resume its natural flow. Sometimes I can tell just by looking at someone where their karmic balance is. It's that obvious. Not long after I started my agency, a girl from the old neighborhood came to me because she thought she was getting gypped a few bucks by a manicurist who did her nails twice a week. This is the kind of petty stuff she lost sleep over. What I later found out was that this chick was banging her brother-in-law and had given him gonorrhea. The brother-in-law passed along the favor to my erstwhile client's sister, then blamed her for the disease. I didn't know all this when she walked into my office, but I didn't have to. Her bad karma was hanging over her head like a cartoon safe. It scared me just to be in the room with this cow. I told her, never mind the manicures, she better start saving starving children or invent a cure for AIDS or something. She used a bunch of love words on me and threw my 1964 World's Fair snow globe against the wall. I wish I could say that this was what tipped the balance for this monster, but compared to what she'd done in the rest of her life, it was like Papa Doc littering on the street of Port-au-Prince. 3 weeks later, this putana is driving her IROC Z down 86th Street when a raised manhole cover catches her dragging muffler and drives the red-hot tailpipe up into the gas tank. She got third-degree burns over 20% of her body and a charred one hand so badly, three fingers had to be amputated. Most of the people who come into my office aren't in that league, but it's the human tendency to feel bad karma is undeserved. Everybody cries with their own eyes. I take maybe 10% of the would-be clients who walk in the door and give another 30% or 40% some free advice they'll disregard. I do it because I have karma, too. My office is on the second floor, above the Fanzong Chinese Apothecary on Barrow Street in the West Village. The upside is that I have never seen a cockroach in my office, despite my habit of leaving takeout remains in the trash for days at a time. This, in Manhattan, is a miracle approximately as great as the virgin birth. The downside is that there's always a certain acrid tang in the office, as if they've been curing mummy reptile organs in a coal-fired oven downstairs. The day that Charbonneau came in, the smell was particularly getting on my nerves, and I decide to go out to check out his ex-fiancée right away, just to be out of the office. I tell Gerald I probably won't be back before closing, tacit permission for him to slip out a little early if he wants, and I head uptown to the Columbus Middle School on West 77th, where Becky teaches 7th and 8th grade social studies. I tell the school security officer at the door that I have a kid in Miss Sandor's class. I'm a little depressed that he believes I'm old enough to have a kid in the 7th or 8th grade. I think I've blown it when I have to ask where the classroom is, but there are a lot of career mothers on the Upper West Side. His father usually does the teacher conferences, I say, sounding guilty. That was enough to get me in. Becky is at her desk, grading a stack of homework. Even a quick look around the room tells me she's paying for a bunch of little extras out of her pocket. The New York City Board of Education is a notoriously stingy bureaucracy. Maps and professionally done timelines line the sides of the room, and there's a little bookshelf with lots of non-textbooks in it. "Hi," she says uncertainly. Her voice is a little nasal. Like the guard, I'm sure she thinks I'm a parent. I don't know how I'm going to play it until I see her, but it turns out she's one of those people whose karma I could read from across the street. It's on the plus side, not hugely, but certainly not what I'd expect from a gal who just done her man wrong. I have a strong gut feeling, and I go with it. "Hi, my name is Debbie Colavito," I say. Becky does a quick little double take. "You're that karma detective, right?" she says. "I read about you in The Voice." I didn't think anybody read The Village Voice anymore. I stopped reading it when they got rid of Jules Pfeiffer's strip. But the profile did a lot for my business, and people are still bringing it up when they meet me more than a year later. "That's right," I say, shaking her hand. "I'm actually here to talk to you about Will Charbonneau." Her expression dims immediately when I say her ex-boyfriend's name. "What about him?" "He wants to know what happened, naturally," I say. "He's under the impression that your departure was out of the blue and that it's, well, undeserved." She sighs and looks at her hands. I notice she's a nail biter. Her cuticles are a mess. "I told Will he might have had it coming," I start to say, but Becky cuts me off with a little shake of the head. "No, he really didn't," she says. "I'm not especially proud of the way I left Will, but part of the reason I just bolted is that I have no idea what to say to him." "He said you met another guy?" I say it without a tone of accusation. "Yes, but maybe I'm fooling myself, but I don't think I would have left Will if I wasn't ready to go," she says, looking up from her hands. "I met this guy professionally, and just being around him just underlined what was missing in my relationship." "And that was?" "Feeling," she said, "an edge. He did all the right things, Will. He said all the right things. He would say he loved me, and I wanted to hear it. And he listened to me. He could tell me a conversation we had 6 months before. But I always felt like he was... It sounds icky when I say this out loud, but he was too nice. I think I let it go on a lot longer than I should have," she said. "But we had so much in common. Teaching, and we met in the Peace Corps, and we were both from College Point. And he's really attractive. My friends think I'm an idiot for leaving him." She rummaged in her bag for a packet of tissues. "Excuse me," she says after blowing her nose. "I have a pretty good cold, you know, being around the kids all day." "How did you meet this new guy?" I ask. "Oscar," she says. "I bought my car in for service at the dealership. He's a salesman, and we got to talking while I was waiting." "Did he try to sell you a car?" I ask. "Oh, no," she laughed. "Not at all. I approached him, in fact. He was reading the paper, and I asked if I could have the Metro section. We got to talking, and he's an Islanders fan like me. We both have season tickets. We had a nice talk. He's really funny. And I went back 2 days later and asked him to lunch." She was blushing a little and back to looking at her hands again. "I'm not one of those women who goes through a lot of guys," she says, "and I try not to flinch when the unintended barb zings home. I was only with one other guy before Will in college, plus a few dates with other guys, But Oscar just struck me somehow. He's very different from Will, she says with a little laugh. One thing that always amazes me about this line of work is what people will tell you if you just let them. Different, I'm about to ask, but she looks at her watch and starts. Oh my God, she says, and starts gathering up her papers. I have a class up at TC in 20 minutes. I'll walk you out, I say. TC? Teachers College, Columbia, she says. I'm getting my master's in education. Her car is parked on the street right near the school, and I don't have a chance to pump her for any more information. We shake hands hurriedly and say goodbye. I'm about to walk away when she rolls down the window. You don't need to tell Will everything I said, do you? She says. It would be mean. I shake my head. I'll probably just say you fell out of love, I tell her. That covers a lot of ground. He's a good guy, she says. I probably am an idiot for dumping him. I nod and we wave goodbye. I want to tell her that sometimes you need to be a little bit hard in this world. But I've been told I have a mean streak, and it hasn't made me a happier person. When she pulls out of the space, I note the name of her dealership on the license plate frame. It isn't 4 o'clock yet, and on a whim, I decide to go eyeball Oscar.